Good day. Today is Friday, 10th October 2025, and before I begin with the substance of this video, let me remind you again to tick the like button once you've either watched the video or that part of the video that you want to watch, and I have decided that you want to tick the like button because you've liked what you heard. Let's then move on to the rest of this program. And firstly, we have confirmation now that there is a ceasefire in effect in Gaza. Presumably people are being released. The Israeli cabinet has confirmed that decision. And well, we will see whether this new agreement lasts. I very much hope it does. Of course, all sorts of people are claiming credit for brokering and negotiating this agreement. I'm not going to revisit all those topics. All I would say is that if people enjoy a period of peace and a period of calm, if prisoners and hostages are released, then that in and of itself is a good thing. But as a number of people have reminded us, there was a ceasefire, a very similar ceasefire, negotiated on relatively similar terms, also with various stages intended to secure a full and lasting peace in Gaza. Anyway, there was such a ceasefire negotiated shortly after President Trump was inaugurated back in January of this year. And that ceasefire only held for about a month before it collapsed. So one can hope, but one should also be realistic. The chances for the moment for a long-term resolution of this crisis, whilst they might perhaps have increased, it's very far from certain that they have actually done so and that we've really turned the corner on this crisis. So that's what I wanted to say about the events in Gaza. Now, there's been a strange epilogue, if you will, which is that many people are claiming that the announcements of the ceasefire were pushed through by the White House and the American negotiators in order for the announcement to come immediately prior to the announcement of who the winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize would be. And President Trump, of course, has been busy, as has been obvious to anybody who has been watching developments over the last few weeks. He's been busy, and many members of his administration have been busy campaigning for the Nobel Peace Prize to be awarded to him. And the assumption, or at least the claim, is that the achievement of a ceasefire in Gaza was partly intended, or mostly intended, to make it possible for the Nobel Peace Prize Committee to award the Peace Prize to President Trump. Now, I don't know whether this is so or not, whether the timing of the ceasefire had anything to do with the debates of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee. But anyway, and in the event, the prize did not go to Donald Trump. It went instead to Maria Corina Machado, a Venezuelan politician, about whom I will have more to say in a moment. Anyway, to repeat again, I have found this quest that President Trump has embarked on to achieve the Nobel Peace Prize bizarre, frankly bizarre, and ultimately self-defeating. I don't understand myself quite why he is so fixated on obtaining the Nobel Peace Prize. Barack Obama obtained the Nobel Peace Prize, and President Trump seems to nurse a perpetual grievance about this. Again, I can't think why. President Trump has made the point himself that President Obama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize shortly after he became president, without any really substantive grounds for why he was awarded it. I would have thought that was a reason to have absolutely nothing to do with a prize like this. If it can be awarded for those kind of reasons, because the Nobel Peace Prize Committee felt some kind of political kinship with Barack Obama, or whatever the reason was, then it is obviously not a prize worth having. Or so I would have thought. To repeat again what I have said now several times, this quest for the Nobel Peace Prize, the fact in the event that President Trump achieves that quest and is one day awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, it doesn't enhance him, as far as I'm concerned. On the contrary, it diminishes him. And I think some people in Washington, in his team, in the White House, perhaps should take him to one side and should explain that to him. Now, as to the winner of this year's Peace Prize, that is Maria Corina Machado. She is indeed a Venezuelan politician. She is politically very much on the right in Venezuelan politics, or so I understand. She has been a consistent opponent, first of the previous Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, and of his successor, Chavez's successor, the current president of Venezuela, President Maduro. And of course, all of this comes at a time when American pressure on Venezuela appears to be increasing, with the deployment of large numbers of forces close to Venezuela's coastline. Now, again, it seems to me that however you spin this decision to award Maria Corina Machado's decision, most people who are not completely, bedazzled by this prize, will see this as another example of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee doing what it often does, which is awarding prizes to people who governments and powerful forces in the West approve of against their opponents. She is the sort of person, in other words, who, if you like, right-thinking opinion in Europe, and by the way, once upon a time in the United States, might have felt that she was the right person to award the prize to. And of course, the fact that the prize has been awarded just at a time when tensions surrounding Venezuela are increasing, and where there is growing talk of regime change in Venezuela, forced regime change involving potential American military intervention in Venezuela. Well, many people will think that this is not a coincidence, and it is a way of signalling approval and support for that regime change, especially if the eventual new leader of Venezuela, as a result of that regime change, turns out to be none other than Maria Corina Machado. Anyway, again, I don't propose to say anything more about this in this programme, but just bear that in mind, the fact that Trump himself has not received the Nobel Peace Prize doesn't mean that it doesn't continue to be an institution which, let us say, has its biases, and those biases, as far as I'm concerned, have again been there, are again evident in its latest award. Now, let us return to the perennial topic of these programmes, which is the conflict in Ukraine. And let me first begin by saying that overnight, we had what may have been the single most devastating combined missile and drone strike launched by Russia against the Ukrainian energy system that we have yet seen. I don't think it was the biggest strike in terms of the numbers of drones and missiles used by the Russians, but it was an enormous strike. Something like 480 drones were launched, according to the Ukrainians, and very large numbers of missiles. And several of the missiles were apparently Kinjal missiles. The Russians are essentially confirming as much. And some of the missiles were also ballistic missiles, in other words, Iskander missiles, and they were also launched as well. And amongst the missiles that the Russians launched, I noticed that the Ukrainians also claim that they included KH-69 air-launched missiles, launched perhaps from Sukhoi 57, fifth generation Russian fighter jets. The KH-69 is a stealth missile. It is, I believe, subsonic. It is apparently very similar, in fact, closely analogous to the American JASSM missile, which has been spoken about as a possible missile that the United States might eventually supply to Ukraine. Anyway, whatever. The Russians apparently launched at least one of these missiles, their equivalent missile, against a Ukrainian target. And interestingly, the Ukrainians say that out of 30 Russian missiles that were launched against Ukraine, the Ukrainians were only able to shoot down 15. In other words, the Ukrainians admit to only a 50% successful hit rate. Probably the reality is significantly less than that. And I would add, and for the record, that amongst the ballistic missiles that the Russians apparently launched over the course of this strike, several, perhaps four, were Iskander K missiles. The Iskander K's launch cruise missiles, a special type of cruise missile. And I wonder whether that 30 includes those missiles or perhaps not. Who knows? But anyway, there's a cluster, I believe, of three cruise missiles launched in the event that there's a launch of a single Iskander K. The Iskander K, by the way, is a controversial missile, or was a controversial missile at one time, because the United States claimed that the cruise missiles that it launched had a range which violated the then extant Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. I do not propose to revive that whole discussion in this program. Anyway, the Russians also launched something like 480 Garand drones, according to the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians, as always, claimed that they shot down the great majority of them, 420, I believe, from memory. Might have been more, might have been less. But anyway, the reality, anyway, in my opinion, is that once again, the Ukrainians are unlikely to have shot down anywhere close to the number of Garand drones that they say they did. So a huge strike, and it was focused principally on Ukraine's energy system. And the Russian Defense Ministry has provided its own account of the strike. And I will read what it said. Last night, in response to what they call terrorist acts launched by the Kiev regime against civilian facilities on the territory of Russia, I presume that is a reference to the Ukrainian drone attacks on Russian oil refineries. The armed forces of the Russian Federation delivered a massive strike with ground and air-based high-precision weapons, Kinjal hypersonic launched ballistic missiles, as well as unmanned aerial vehicles at energy infrastructure facilities that ensured operation of Ukrainian defense industry enterprises. The goal of the strike was achieved. All the assigned targets were engaged. And lest we forget, the Russian Defense Ministry then went on to say, in addition, during the week, the armed forces of the Russian Federation carried out six massive group strikes with high precision weapons and unmanned aerial vehicles, neutralizing enterprises of the defense industry and energy facilities of Ukraine, railway and maritime infrastructure used to transport weapons and military hardware, fuel depots, storage and launch preparation areas of unmanned aerial vehicles, as well as temporary deployment areas of the Ukrainian military and foreign mercenaries. So, according to the Russians, they have conducted six big strikes over the course of the last week. And the latest strike, presumably one of those six, appears in some respects, at least, to have been the most powerful. Now, going back to the start of the Russian aerial offensive against Ukraine exactly 2 years ago in October 2022, I remember that at that time the Russians basically launched air and missile strikes against Ukraine, these big massive strikes that the Russian Defense Ministry is talking about. They at that time were launching them roughly twice a month. Now they are launching them at the rate of six over the course of a single week. That perhaps gets the best sense of all of the extent to which the Russian offensive in the sky against Ukraine has intensified. It has intensified by orders of magnitude beyond what we saw at its start in October 2022. And of course, at that time, I thought it was already pretty devastating. So we can imagine what the effect of these strikes, these hammer blows, is like. Now, the result of the latest strike is power blackouts across many places in Ukraine. Odessa was one of the places that was particularly badly hit, but so was Kiev. And at the time when I am making this program, which is fairly early in the morning on the 10th of October, the reports suggest that parts of the energy system, the electricity system in Ukraine, in Kiev, is still down, that the metro is working, the Kiev metro is only partially working, that there are problems with electricity supplies, including to residential neighbourhoods, and also that water supplies across Kiev are affected as well. Now, in the winter of 2022-2023, as the Russian air offensive of that time hammered Kiev, I remember that there were reports appearing in the Western media that Ukrainian officials were becoming so concerned about the situation in Kiev that they were giving serious thoughts to evacuating the entire civilian population from the city. I did not believe that at the time, and I do not believe this is part of Ukraine's plans even now. I think that the Ukrainians were saying that at the time in order to highlight the scale of the Russian missile offensive of the winter of 2022-2023, because, as I also remember, at that time they were engaging in a massive lobbying campaign in Western capitals and mostly in Washington to get the United States to agree to supply Patriot systems to Ukraine, which of course up to that time had not been supplied previously. Having said this, that is what the Ukrainians were saying at that time, that if the offensive continued on the scale that was the case in the winter of 2022-2023, then Kiev would become unbearable for the civilian population and it would have to be evacuated. Well, if that's what the Ukrainian authorities were saying in 2022-2023, what are they going to say now when the Russian drone and missile offensive in the sky is so much greater? Remember, two big missile strikes a month over the course of the winter of 2022-2023. Sometimes there were a few more, occasionally they were less. This time, six massive strikes, according to the Russian Defense Ministry, over the course of a single week. And the missiles, by the way, look to be a lot more powerful. Kinjals and Iskanders mostly. And the Ukrainians are admitting that a bigger proportion of them is getting through. I will be very interested to see whether the Ukrainians come forward this time and say that it is time for the civilian population to be evacuated from Kiev, whether they will make the same claim to Western capitals that they are on the brink of ordering this, whether they will do anything like that. I'm going to say it straightforwardly. I don't anticipate that they will. By now, they've received lots of Patriot missile systems. They're continuing to receive some from Germany and from Israel. Media outlets in the West are acknowledging that these Patriot missile systems are not successful in shooting down, are increasingly ineffective, was the word used by the Financial Times, in shooting down incoming Russian missiles. So I suspect that the Ukrainian authorities, have no similar need to demand Patriot missile systems from the West that they had in 2022-2023, because then in 2022-2023, these systems could be sold to the Ukrainian public and to the Western public as miracle weapons that would transform the situation in the sky, and their delivery could be sold also as a further act of commitment by the United States to the cause of Ukraine. And after so many Patriot missile systems have already been delivered to Ukraine and have had, well, in general, mediocre to poor results, well, none of that applies anymore. Anyway, that was what happened last night. A massive Russian missile and drone strike, and we've had six over the course of this week. Who knows how many we will get next week? All of the indications are that the war in the sky is going to continue at the same level of intensity until at least the end of the year and perhaps beyond. And in the meantime, Ukraine's industrial plant, its energy system, its railway system, which the Russians basically did not attack in 2022-2023, all of these are buckling and are beginning to break down. In fact, I'm getting more and more reports about how the crisis in the energy system is intensifying on a scale that we have never seen. And of course, as I discussed in my program yesterday, Bloomberg has confirmed that up to 60% of Ukraine's natural gas reserves, and by the way, production capacity for natural gas, has been lost over the course of the Russian missile strikes of the last few weeks. So this offensive in the sky continues. And to be clear, there is nothing essentially that the Western powers can do about this. As I discussed in my program yesterday, there was another debate in Europe amongst European capitals about loosening the restrictions on NATO militaries in shooting down Russian drones and aircraft that either approach or stray into NATO airspace. But it seems that no decision has yet been made. And, well, it doesn't seem as if there's been any decision about anything very much over the last few weeks from NATO, from the Europeans, from the Americans either. Certainly nothing that much connected with the countering this Russian missile and drone offensive. I can remember again how back in 2022, 2023, Ursula von der Leyen was joining in the Ukrainian lobbying effort to get the United States to supply Patriot missiles to Ukraine. I can remember how European officials and leaders used to hold one summit meeting after another discussing the importance of helping Ukraine counter this Russian offensive in the sky, and how at that time, 2 years ago, there was unending talk about finding means to defend Ukraine from these Russian drone and missile strikes. That was 2022-2023. Today, the Russian offensive in the sky is, as we see, orders of magnitude greater. And what do we hear about this? We hear nothing. There are no hurried meetings. There is no strong words from Western officials. There's no talk about more air defense missiles. Because, as we know, after 2 years of war, 4 years of war, the number of air defense missile interceptors in the West has declined to critical levels. They have not been able to keep up, not remotely, with Russia's offensive capabilities, the increase in those Russian offensive capabilities. There are reports that the United States is now restricting exports of Patriot missile interceptors because inventories of these weapons are so short in the United States itself. In Europe, the Germans continue to produce IRIS-Ts. I haven't heard much about NASAMS deliveries from Norway for a while. And, well, the French and the Italians apparently have pretty much exhausted their ability to supply Ukraine with the Aspide system that we once heard so much about. The number of those was always very small, and apparently it takes years to achieve successful production. So Ukraine is facing this missile and drone offensive from Russia. It is about to receive some apparently rather old Patriot missile systems from Israel, two, and I believe three more from Germany. But that's about it. And these are systems rather than interceptor missiles. And it is likely that even after these systems are sent to Ukraine, there won't be enough interceptors to keep them functioning. So that's already a crisis. I should say that my own impression is that weapons deliveries to Ukraine from the West have dwindled markedly over the course of the last year. There was a massive surge of deliveries by the United States in the last weeks of the Biden administration, and the Biden administration committed the United States to providing large numbers of further weapons, extending into the first months of the incoming Trump administration. Apart from a brief stop in March, the United States has continued with those deliveries, but my sense is that they're running down, and I've noticed that the Pentagon seems to have largely stopped providing us with the very interesting updates about weapons deliveries that we used to see and which used to be explained so masterfully by Brian Beletic. And if we're talking about weapons deliveries from Europe, from the European states, well, some do take place. But again, I get the sense that they are fewer and less than was the case before. And that might bring us back to the whole topic of the Tomahawk cruise missiles, which are recently, again, being talked about so much. Now, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, has just had a meeting with President Alexander Stubb of Finland. Stubb has set himself out as perhaps one of Europe's most hardline figures, and that is saying an awful lot. It is astonishing to someone like me, who remembers the long decades of very good relations between Finland and first the Soviet Union and then Russia, whose memory in terms of Finnish politics extends back to the Kekkonen era, which lasted for decades as well, over the course of which Finland prospered, and during which Finland was not just a neutral country, but one with very good relations with the Soviet Union, and which actually used to import weapons from the Soviet Union, including MiG fighter jets, just saying. Anyway, it's astonishing to me to see this complete reversal in Finland, how the Finns have gone from being one of the European countries that were friendliest towards the Russians to being led by a leader, Alexander Stubb, who is one of the most hardline and hostile. I am not up to date, by the way, with the realities of the Finnish economy, but I understand that the complete break in economic and trade links between Finland and Russia is having severe negative economic effects in Finland itself. I've even heard some claims about recession. Well, people from Finland can either confirm or refute that. But even if all of that is true, it doesn't seem as if, in the case of President Stubb, that is causing him to change his mind. Anyway, President Stubb met with President Trump. He's, at various times, by the way, Stubb has floated this idea that he and Trump have established a very friendly relationship, that Trump sees Stubb as one of his closest and friendliest partners in Europe. There's been claims that the two leaders are golf buddies, that they play golf together. I understand that in reality, Stubb has played golf with Trump, all but once, just saying. But anyway, Stubb has marketed himself rather successfully as being one of the European leaders who gets on best with Donald Trump and is able to influence his views. Anyway, they met, they talked, they had a fair amount of discussions, and well, it may be that I've not seen the entirety of Donald Trump's comments, but though Stubb did seem to push Trump on taking a harder line with the Russians, which, by the way, he always does, and tried to get Trump to commit to more sanctions against the Russians, which Trump sort of did, but without giving the appearance of any very great conviction. It seemed to me that there was one major gaping hole, and that is that, as far as I could tell, no mention of the Tomahawks was made. It didn't seem as if Trump was keen to bring up the subject of the Tomahawks, and it looks as if Stubb, at least, wasn't prepared to push, at least publicly, for them either. Now, a couple of days ago, about last week, Trump made a very ambivalent comment about the Tomahawks, sort of implying that he'd made a decision, though it wasn't clear whether it was to send them or not to send them, just saying. And there's been other comments by General Kellogg talking about how if the Tomahawks were ever sent to Ukraine, they would be a game changer. And there were also comments by J.D. Vance, which, having heard in their entirety, I think were somewhat overinterpreted. And some people thought that they implied that Vance was in favour of supplying the Tomahawks to Ukraine. But as I said, having heard the entirety of what Vance actually said, I don't think he was intending to give that impression at all. Anyway, put all that aside, I have now been contacted by a number of people, one of whom I should say is, and I'm probably disclosing something that, well, it was an email by Ray McGovern, one of the co-founders of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, a person who has immense knowledge and understanding of US-Russia relations, who remembers the whole world of arms control and all the various controversies about the deployment of Tomahawk nuclear equipped missiles in Europe in the early 1980s. And Ray McGovern has poured cold water over the whole idea of the United States being able to supply Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. Obviously anything is possible, but he's pointed to the enormous technical challenges. And he referred me, as, by the way, Jeff Roberts, the historian, has also referred me, to a really interesting, very interesting article about Tomahawk missiles and how they work and the difficulties operating these missiles by Black Mountain Analysis, of which I was completely unaware. And this article, which can be found on Black Mountain Analysis' Substack blog, Tomahawk for Ukraine, Never-Ending Saga of the Wunderwaffe to Turn the Tide, really is absolutely interesting. It is written by somebody called Mike Mihailovich, who I presume is some kind of defence expert or engineering expert. It goes into details about the colossal challenge of deploying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, much of which goes far beyond anything that I had suspected. Anyway, briefly, back in the 1970s, when the Tomahawk was first developed, There was an actual land mobile version of the Tomahawk missile, which was on a transport, on a mobile launch vehicle. But after the INF Treaty of 1987, all of those systems were taken out of service and the entire project was cancelled, and no such vehicles exist today. I would add that those vehicles, which were developed in the 1970s, would have been designed for the strategic version of the Tomahawk that carried a nuclear weapon. Now, I am not an engineering or technical expert at all, but I wonder whether more modern versions of the Tomahawk would anyway be compatible with the transporter vehicle that was developed in the 1970s. The answer is perhaps yes, but as Mr. Mihailovich points out, reviving that program would be a massive undertaking. It would take a complete rediscovery, in effect, of that old technology from the 1970s. We would be talking about a major program which would perhaps take a year, perhaps longer, to bring to fruition. So that system is simply not available today. And I think that suggestions that it would be that some simpler system, lighter system than the Typhon system, the existing Typhon system, could be brought into service and done so quickly. I think that the only viable lighter system would be something that was very like the system that existed in the 1970s. And, well, this article basically sets out the enormous technical and industrial problems. And then the article goes into enormous detail about the current version of the Tomahawk, which is principally a naval system used by the US Navy for land attack. And of course, it is indeed carried in canisters. There have been all kinds of plans and projects to carry these canisters and to use them on lighter vehicles. None of them have ever been put into anything like service, and it seems that no program exists. And besides that, the Typhon system, as we've discussed already, massive, complex system, hardly suitable for use in Ukraine itself. And the article then goes beyond that and discusses how the existing Tomahawk missile is part of a weapons system that is completely integrated into the US Navy, that it relies at every point for input from all kinds of systems and subsystems and technicians and people who obviously the Navy has and the US military has. But it is simply not a system that could, by any stretch of the imagination, be operated by the Ukrainians, not just by themselves, but even in conjunction with the Americans in any short, realistic time frame. So the overall conclusion reading this article, and I have no reason, by the way, to dispute it, is that this whole plan is simply unworkable in any time frame which is shorter than, well, at the very least, a year, probably much longer still. If a decision was made to supply Ukraine with Tomahawk missiles today, it's most unlikely, I think, that Ukraine would get any before 2027. And I say Ukraine, in fact, what that would mean is the United States installing and operating Tomahawk missiles in Ukraine itself. And 2027 might in fact be an optimistic time frame. It might even take longer than that. And given the difficulties and given the dangers, presumably there would have to be air defense systems created to protect these missiles, air defense missiles, air defense systems, which, as we of course also know, the United States and the Europeans are currently desperately short of. Now, what this means, if this is correct, and to repeat again, I suspect it is correct, is that this entire discussion about Tomahawk missiles has a complete lack of reality about it. It might have been intended to alarm and threaten the Russians, but as I've said already, it can't and it won't. And for the further record, if there is a plan to do it, if some people in the US government and in Ukraine are advocating it, more likely than not, they simply don't understand. They don't know what they're talking about. They just do not grasp the enormous problems. And of course, there has already been an article in Reuters, and I believe there have been similar articles in the American media, which have basically also said that this isn't a realistic idea and should be dropped. So, firstly, let me first of all take this opportunity to thank both Ray McGovern and Jeff Roberts for forwarding this article to me and for explaining the position. And well, I think that this is definitive and true. I wonder, though, whether the President of the United States, Donald Trump, when the idea of the Tomahawks was first floated, fully understood the problems. Whether when Zelensky perhaps first suggested it to him, he might have thought that this was a good idea because he didn't know very much about the complexities of the system. And when people like General Kellogg and Mike Waltz perhaps advocated the supply of these systems to Ukraine also, that Trump himself didn't understand either how the Russians would perceive this whole discussion or the immense difficulties that this delivering this system would pose. And well, I have to say, if that was the case, then it would not be the first time. I get the sense that very often the president makes assumptions about the capabilities of the US military and of its weapons systems that go beyond the realities. In his recent speech, for example, to the US military, the generals and the admirals, he spoke about how the United States was decades ahead of Russia and China in submarines. And well, this is about the one thing that I have spoken with people who know about these things. They tell me categorically that isn't true. If we're talking about the very latest Russian nuclear submarines, in some respects, technologically, they might even be ahead of those of the Americans. Anyway, I'm not going to get sidetracked into discussing all of that. So, most unlikely, we're going to see Tomahawk missiles being supplied to Ukraine, and we're not going to see more air defense missiles supplied to Ukraine, and weapon supplies to Ukraine appear to be dwindling. We don't get anything like the enthusiasm that we once did to send armored vehicles to Ukraine. Again, I remember how in the autumn of 2022, there was extraordinary euphoria when the European states and then the United States started to supply heavy armored vehicles to Ukraine, none of which, by the way, proved a game changer. and we've had all of these waves of euphoria about particular weapons. It doesn't look as if these weapons are in fact coming in the quantities that they were. And as for Ukrainian missiles, I read a report yesterday that for the first time, the Ukraine did indeed launch a Flamingo missile, cruise missile, at a target in Russia. This enormous V1 type missile, slow and big and non-stealthy. And well, unsurprisingly, the Russians immediately shot it down. Apparently, it didn't penetrate deep inside Russia at all. The strike, which the Ukrainians tried to carry out with it, was unsuccessful. I think we are now at that stage in the war when there should be no further illusions about this. Weapons that the West has supplied to Ukraine are never going to arrive in the numbers that would be needed to turn the situation round. And the illusion that Western weapons are so superior to Russian weapons that they can somehow, even in small numbers, decisively affect the outcome. That is an illusion as well, and one that should be abandoned also. I suspect that deep down, Western militaries, the US military, the European militaries, know and understand this, even if perhaps there is still some reluctance to explain this to their political masters. Anyway, the question of the Tomahawks now brings me back to this very vexed question of the debate that is taking place in Russia. And I want to stress it is a debate. It is not a power struggle that some people are talking about. President Putin, definitely, in my opinion, continues to hold to a more moderate course than other people in the Russian Security Council and in the Kremlin and in the political and military leadership would prefer that he followed. And there is a tug of war going on, and well, maybe not a tug of war, but an active debate on all of this going on. It's important, however, to distinguish what is a debate or an argument, if you prefer, playing out at the highest levels of the Russian leadership, to distinguish and to differentiate that from an active power struggle. Now, I have witnessed power struggles in Russia, and I can say straight away that none of the signs of a power struggle are there. If there really were moves to oust Putin, by now they would be fully obvious, and frankly, I see none. I can remember, for example, when there was clearly a power struggle underway in Moscow in 1999, when Yeltsin was in the last months of his, as it turned out, last final presidential term, when there were sudden movements by the Russian military in Kosovo, when there were uncertainties as to who the prime minister of Russia would be, with Yeltsin dismissing Primakov, and then after some hesitation, Putin appearing on the scene, and then Putin effectively appearing to take charge in August of 1999, and then Putin himself trying to sack various generals, as I remember, around the new year, 1999, 2000, just after he took over as acting president of Russia, and then Putin having to reverse himself over this, and then Putin being elected, and then taking steps to basically expel from Russia certain very powerful Russian oligarchs. Well, that was a power struggle, and there is absolutely nothing like that taking place in Russia today. But I have no doubt that there is a debate, and it is a fraught debate, or at least a strong debate, and we see indications of it spilling out into the Russian media. So over the course of my last two programs, and also in programs that have been done for the Duran, I said that the Russian Foreign Ministry, Sergei Ryabkov, had delivered a very pessimistic perspective on the future of US-Russia relations and political moves, diplomatic moves, to end the conflict in Ukraine in a report that he gave to the Russian parliament, to the Duma. And I also spoke about how Putin himself then had a meeting with the Russian generals and was very careful over the course of that meeting to avoid any mention of any diplomatic initiatives to end the war. And there were other commentaries that were appearing in the Russian media at that time, which also seemed to strongly indicate that the Russians, that the hardliners, if I can call them that, I would hesitate, by the way, to call them hardliners. Anyway, people who are much more deeply sceptical of the whole process of engagement with the United States, how these people seemed to be gaining ground. Well, over the last 24 hours, we see that Putin himself and people very close to him, like his foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, have tried to push back. So Ushakov has given an interview to Pavel Zarubin, in which he says that Russia, Moscow and Washington remain in constant contact based on agreements and understandings reached in Alaska. We continue working with the Americans on the basis of the agreements reached by the presidents in Anchorage. And he was critical of the Europeans and the Ukrainians. He said that those who do not want the Ukraine crisis to be resolved peacefully have been busy, but that doesn't mean that the Russians themselves are not working. So anyway, Ushakov still seemed keen to keep the door open to the Trump administration to some degree. And Peskov, Putin's spokesman, has also spoken in somewhat similar terms. And in Dushanbe, over the course of a meeting of leaders from the Confederation of Independent States, the entity that Boris Yeltsin created to take the place of the Soviet Union, but which has had an increasingly shadowy existence ever since, though it still just about exists. Basically, it's Russia, Belarus, and the Central Asian states, just to say. Anyway, over the course of a summit meeting with these states that took place in Dushanbe, Putin made these comments. I've already exchanged information with some colleagues, informing them of the results of our work in Anchorage, Alaska, with the Americans regarding the settlement of the situation in Ukraine. Notice he doesn't mention Trump by name. We will have the opportunity to meet again in a more intimate group and I would like to inform you in more detail at this private meeting about the results, which we generally view as positive. We will certainly base our subsequent work on resolving the conflict in Ukraine on the fundamental principles we discussed in Alaska. Very vague words from Putin, again seeming to leave the door slightly ajar for further diplomatic contacts. To me, again, this looks like pushback against those critics who are saying that Anchorage, Alaska, was a waste of time, that nothing of substance was agreed, that we should just forget about this and focus instead on winning the war. And it's perhaps not surprising that Putin, who has invested so much in this dialogue with Donald Trump, is even now still unwilling to give up fully on it. But to repeat again, he is giving ground, and he is giving ground to his critics, and he has now made public statements that if Tomahawk missiles ever were supplied to Ukraine, then in that case, all of the progress in improving relations between the United States and Russia since Trump was inaugurated would have been for nothing. I wonder whether what might have happened over the last few hours, and I want to stress I don't know this, and this is very, very much speculation. I wonder whether over the last few hours there haven't been some contacts between the Americans and the Russians. Notice how Ushakov is careful to say that the Americans and the Russians are in continuous contact, and whether some people in Washington have said to the Russians, look, pay no attention to all of this talk of Tomahawk missiles. The reality is that they're never going to be supplied to Ukraine, quite apart from anything else. The technical problems in doing that are all but insuperable. We've heard what you are saying, and we are not going there. Well, that might be, but if this whole topic is going to be buried completely, if the Americans really want to help Putin in this discussion, then I'm going to suggest that the president himself come out and simply say that the Tomahawks are not going to be supplied to Ukraine, and this whole thing is a complete red herring, and it's a shame that it was ever brought up at all. I think if that were done, it would end some of this fevered speculation we've been seeing in Europe, and it might cool heads in Kiev, cool heads metaphorically, given the energy crisis in Kiev. Some of the heads there are probably already fairly cool, just saying. But anyway, cool them down and understand, and make them understand that the American cavalry is not going to come. There's not going to be Tomahawks. There's not going to be Patriots. There's not going to be JASSMs missiles. There is another article, by the way, in the same magazine, Black Mountain Analysis. I'm so sorry. Nothing to do with Black Hawk. Black Mountain Analysis, about how the JASSMs, if they were supplied to Ukraine, though they might cause the Russians some problems, they too could never be supplied in anything like the numbers that would be needed to make a decisive change on the battlefields, and that there are technical problems even in supplying those. The only aircraft the Ukrainians have that could launch these missiles of the F-16s, and Ukraine has been supplied with old versions of the F-16s, which would have to be almost completely rebuilt in order to supply to launch those missiles. Again, I'm not going to say get sidetracked into that sort of discussion. So perhaps it would be as well, as I said, if somebody now made it clear to the Ukrainians that there isn't going to be a rescue of Ukraine by the United States, if the same thing were explained to the Europeans, at that point, just possibly, that would cause some people in Ukraine to start thinking seriously about peace negotiations, and it might also lower the temperature in Europe as well, where I can't help but think that much of the drama that we've been seeing about all the talk of war, all the talk about shooting down Russian drones and Russian missiles, in the end, is intended to try to sway the Americans to become more deeply involved in the conflict in Ukraine again. Now, I say all of that. I think one thing has to be said clearly, which is that so long as Zelensky or people who think like him continue to be in control in Ukraine, the Ukrainian government itself will never take meaningful steps towards achieving peace. And so long as the present political structures continue to wield power in Europe, they will support the Ukrainians in that intransigence, in that stance. The Americans may blow hot and cold about relations with Russia and support for diplomatic solutions, and they may come up with completely unrealistic diplomatic solutions which the Russians will never accept. But even if the Americans were to show signs of changing their mind, the immovable object remains, which is that the present political structures in Kiev, Zelensky and his officials and the various backers, various political groups and backers that support them, including the various nationalist brigades, are not interested in a negotiated settlement that would not pave the way for an eventual victory. And the Europeans show no interest in breaking with the Ukrainians on this. They continue to play the same game that they have been playing basically ever since the Maidan coup or seizure of power in February 2014, which is a game of all or nothing. Even as the risk increases, that what they're going to be left with is nothing, they would rather play this game than accept anything less than outright victory. I think, if I have to say it, the nature of the Maidan movement precludes anything else. I have never known it to agree to any compromise at any point in its existence, basically since it emerged as a political force in Ukraine at the time of the Orange Revolution of 2004. And I have to say the same seems to me to be true of the European leadership as well. Even as the situation in Ukraine itself deteriorates, even as the situation in Europe continues to deteriorate, Now, in France, by way of example, President Macron is not prepared to call elections. He is not prepared to resign. He's not, of course, prepared to reach out to Marine Le Pen and the National Rally, which might perhaps be the obvious party to form a government, given that it won a plurality of votes in the last parliamentary elections. And he is not prepared to reach out to the more left-wing grouping led by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, which won the largest number of votes, largest number of seats, in the French Parliament, and which has arguably an even better right to be asked to form a government. He's not prepared to do any of that. He has decided instead that he's going to appoint yet another prime minister, and this time it seems that instead of seeking a prime minister from the centre right, which is what he has been doing for the last year, this time he's going to try and find a prime minister from the centre left, hoping that this person will be able to cobble a coalition together better than his or her predecessors were able to do. I think it is very unlikely that this is going to succeed. It seems to me that even a centre-left prime minister is not going to have support in the French National Assembly. But the crisis in France is being prolonged. But of course, in the meantime, Macron remains president. His popularity continues to sink. It will soon be in single figures at the rate things are taking. But at the same time, he can continue to support Ukraine. He can continue to call for more and continued support for Ukraine, which, to be clear, for him, remains an important priority, as does the larger deal with Russia. And in Germany, it's exactly the same. In fact, we've had economic numbers now published in Germany about the situation there this August. And it looks as if there has been a major fall in Germany in industrial production and in August. And there were reports that, there's been confirmation of some of this. German unemployment figures are rising. And as I discussed in my programme yesterday, it appears, it has been the case that Bosch, the major engineering company, has laid off 22,000 workers. And it looks like there is a deepening crisis in Germany's auto industry, seminally important auto industry as well. But does that mean that the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz is thinking of changing course? No, it does not. It doesn't seem as if there is a critical mass of people within his coalition that would demand a change of course, certainly with respect to support for Ukraine, certainly with respect to this constant policy of conflict with Russia. It doesn't appear as if there is that support within the coalition either. So there is nothing to prevent Merz from continuing on his present course, just as Macron himself seems to be committed to it. So that is the reality. Europe continues on this course, as Ukraine does, and there is no sign of any political shift at all. And for that reason, I think by this time, after 10 months now of various attempts to try to achieve a diplomatic resolution of this conflict, I think we should forget any idea that it will ever come. Putin might still talk about it. He might still hanker for some kind of long-term improvement of relations with the Americans. But I don't see how it's going to come myself. And as for the Americans, bear in mind that Trump himself has never screwed up the courage finally to do what I think he should have done long ago, which is to tell the Europeans, enough's enough, we've done all we can, we cannot do more. Instead, as we have seen with the Tomahawks, he's let this absurd and disastrous idea float around for the last 2 weeks, whereas if he'd really been fully committed to achieving peace in Ukraine, I think he should have killed it off outright, right from the beginning. He's strung along both the Ukrainians and the Europeans, and in a different way, the Russians, by holding this idea out. And even now, publicly, he hasn't gone out and killed it. So there it is. So that therefore leaves us coming back to the war. Now, I have discussed the latest Substack blog by Marat Khairullin on Substack, and I pointed out that back in March, Marat Khairullin seemed to lay out in detail a great deal about the course of the Russian military campaign in 2025. And I have been startled reading what Khairullin wrote on the 20th of March 2025, looking at it with the advantage of hindsight and seeing how closely it has come true. Well, one of the things that Khairullin said back in 20th March 2025, is that one of the main focus of the Russian offensive as it evolved would be an advance through Dnipropetrovsk region, right up to the Dnieper, to the city of Dnipro. Dnipro would be put under siege. The Russians would then break through. They would cross the Dnieper and, as he put it, on to Odessa. Well, over the last couple of hours, there's been reports of a major redeployment of Russian forces towards the Dnipropetrovsk direction. Russian forces that had been gathered south of Pokrovsk, I don't believe they ever had any particular role in the Battle of Pokrovsk itself. I think they were being held in reserve there. Anyway, they have now been brought closer to the front lines, and the area where they have been brought closer to is this important fortified village of Novopavlivka, which it is likely that the Russians are going to seek to storm over the next few weeks or days. And then it's basically, as I understand it, a relatively open road to the city of Pavlograd and ultimately to the Dnieper, and to the city of Dnipro itself. And, well, the Russians are in the process also of storming the Pokrovska mine, coal mine, southwest of Pokrovsk. And you could see how that also brings them close to the main road that leads to Pavlograd and Dnipro as well. Increasingly, again, it looks to me as if events are starting to follow the lines that Marat Khairullin laid out. Meanwhile, in Pokrovsk itself, the fighting there goes on. And the latest word is that the Russians have now recaptured Vladimirovka, the one village that the Ukrainians recaptured in the breakthrough area. And I think we can now say fairly conclusively that the Ukrainian counterattacks in this area, in the breakthrough area, in the Dobropilia direction, the Ukrainian counterattacks have failed. Mariana Bezuglaya, the dissident Ukrainian MP, has expressed herself in very, very forthright terms about this. She has indignantly criticised implicitly Zelensky, but openly Syrsky, about the various claims about a successful counteroffensive in this area. It's absolutely clear to me that these were all fictions, deceptions, intended to mislead people both in Ukraine and in Europe, but perhaps most of all in the United States, people like Kellogg, for example. And, well, we're now starting to see that all of this was untrue. In fact, all that these counterattacks, in my opinion, have achieved is that they have weakened the Ukrainian forces in precisely this area, making it easier for the Russians to conduct further advances. Anyway, we will discuss all of that and some very alarming recent comments made by Zelensky, in which he again seems to be talking about more assassinations and sabotage operations inside Russia itself. I will discuss all of that in my next program. This is where I'm going to finish today's program. To remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.